But first now to geopolitical power in an oft-overlooked region, and a reminder that we should never forget the power of maps. In a recent essay for Foreign Affairs magazine, the acclaimed American correspondent Robert D. Kaplan argued that the Indian Ocean Rim will take centre stage for the 21st century as a site of commercial and military rivalries. He writes that the Indian Ocean is a geographic feature that, and I'm quoting him, combines the centrality of Islam with global energy politics and the rise of India and China to reveal a multi-layered and multipolar world, and that it illustrates, as ever, that geography matters more than ideas or ideology in international affairs. These geographic connections, he suggests, are transforming the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Indian and Pacific Oceans into one vast continuum. And he predicts that the narrow Straits of Malacca will be the Fulda Gap of the 21st century, that section of land in Germany that could have been the route of a Soviet invasion of Europe during the Cold War. So, why is the Indian Ocean so strategically important? And why have we in Australia given it very little thought? Well, I'm delighted to say that Robert Kaplan joins us this morning. He's the national correspondent for The Atlantic and the senior fellow for the Centre of American Security, at the Centre for American Security. And we're also joined by a former defence minister and now Chancellor of the ANU, Kim Beazley. Kim also advises the major financial services firm Ernst & Young on defence matters. So welcome, gentlemen.
Very good to be here.
Pleasure to be here.
Robert, you paint this vivid picture of the geopolitical fault lines in our region, particularly this emerging struggle between India and China for the control of critical sea lanes. Can you outline just why you believe the Indian Ocean will take center stage for this rivalry?
Well, in a way it already is, because it includes the entire arc of Islam from the Sahara Desert to the Indonesian archipelago. If you look at India and China, they're spending their money increasingly to go to sea. They're expressing their new power in the ocean. The Indian Navy's percentage of the Indian defense budget has doubled since the early 1990s. The Indian Chief of Naval Staff expects that by 2022, India will have 160 warships, including three aircraft carrier strike groups, submarines, etc. China has also been has a basic shop till you drop policy on increasing the size of its submarine force, both diesel electric and nuclear as well. Now, India and China constitute one of the world's biggest trading relationships, and that will stabilize the relationship to a great degree. But there will be a hard edge to their relationship, and it's liable to be expressed at sea. The Indian Ocean is the world's global interstate, energy interstate. It's where all the oil from the Middle East crosses over the Indian Ocean to the burgeoning middle-class fleshpots of Asia, China and the Pacific Rim. And it's going to be control of sea lanes, protecting the sea lanes. I'm not predicting war or anything like that. I'm just saying that the Indian Ocean is going to be far more central to geopolitics than it has been in the 20th century.
And as you say, both countries are building up their naval power, and you didn't mention Japan there, I think, either.
No, I didn't, and I should have, because Japan also is seeking a greater Indian Ocean presence.
While perhaps America and its Western allies have been very much focused on land-based conflict. So it's an interesting distinction, isn't it?
Yes, well, America's been focused on dirty land wars because of Iraq and Afghanistan. That's understandable. But if you look ahead, navies are often a very good way to judge the military strength of a country in total. And the American Navy, while still far and away the largest in the world, with a Coast Guard that would be considered the ninth largest navy in the world, nevertheless has gone from 600 warships at the end of the Cold War down to 279 now.
Kim, can I bring you in? Are you in broad agreement with Robert on the future military and commercial significance of the Indian Ocean?
Yeah, I am, and I'm impressed with him. He probably doesn't know it, but that article that he wrote for Foreign Affairs disrupted the production of the seamless production of the recent Australian Defence White Paper. I'm told that the strategic elements of it being completed basically before Christmas. His article came out, the Prime Minister read it, thought it was terrific, so Robert can claim some credit paragraph 443 if he bothers to read it.
But thank you, I'll have to read it then. Yeah.
Look, the... you know, what I found was interesting about Robert's article and his general disposition, his general argument, he's actually reintroducing a way that we used to think about the zone, at least in Australia, back in the 1960s and 70s, and it got out of the habit. The notion that we are on the part of the literal of a single geopolitical entity was easy for us to contemplate in the latter phases of the Cold War, and since then has dropped off. But what brought it into focus for Australia back in the 1960s and 70s was just the beginnings of a rivalry which did not go terribly far between the Soviet Union and the United States, with the US securing facilities at Diego Garcia, the Soviets looking at offshore facilities in the Red Sea and so on. And there was argument about was the Indian Ocean to be drawn into the vortex of superpower competition? Well, it was always a sideline in superpower competition, a backwater, if you like, because the flashpoints points of that Cold War with Northern Asia and Europe. But now that the focus of the global political system is the Asia-Pacific region, at least economically, and the principal fault line is argument over the fate of Islam, Australia finds itself from being comfortably situated in a strategic backwater to being in the southern tier of what is the focus of global politics. It's an interesting challenge.
Yes. And do you think we've grasped that yet? I mean, how would you rate the sophistication of our approach?
Yeah, look, I think quite considerably. But I think one of the things that has not been commented on in the recent Australian Defence White Paper is the claim. Now, we talk about being able to dominate our approaches, and we give it a geographical description, which is basically the Southeast Asian archipelago. Nobody thought very much of that when we claimed it in the self-reliance strategy in 1987. But now in 2009, what are we claiming? We are claiming a capacity to dominate militarily the southern tier of the focus of the global political system, which is incorporates at least the approaches to that full the gap type status for the Straits of Malacca that Robert was talking about.
So is politics then at the mercy of geography, as Robert suggests? Or Robert suggests in his recent writing that we really ought to get back to thinking like that.
Yes, well, you remember, geography puts constraints on our actions. All the all the technological development over the years doesn't make the full the Strait of Malacca any wider. It's still a narrow passage for a lot of trips, ships. So geography frames the debate, frames our choices, and we thought we got away with that when the Berlin Wall collapsed. We thought that all borders suddenly would be pushed away, democracy would succeed everywhere, and we find that that geography still matters a lot.
In fact, when we tried to talk to you recently, you were actually down in Sri Lanka when this
That's correct.
And we, in fact, did a piece about the Chinese involvement in that Sri Lankan conflict, in fact, heavily assisting the Sri Lankan government, such that the argument is they didn't have to take notice of the rest of the world because they want that southern port, don't they?
And this is it's all about geography. The victory for the Sri Lankan government over the Tamil Tigers was a victory for China. Without China having that government's back at the UN, without all the military support that China gave the Sri Lankan government that didn't come with any moral lessons attached, the Sri Lankan government could not have prevailed. And what is important about Sri Lanka for China? It, like Diego Garcia, it's close to the major sea lines of communication. Whereas in the Cold War, a lot of the action was up in the Arctic, the polar ice cap, the U.S. Navy trying to bottle up the Soviet fleet up there in the northern latitudes. We're going to find in the world we're inheriting that a lot of the action or the concentration will be in the tropics.
Kim, how Can this jostling for position, which I presume is going to take place, how can it be managed ideally or optimally?
Well, managed in the same way that most international political issues are, and particularly when there's shifting balances of power, people negotiate their way through. I think largely the American... I agree with Robert that the United States will return and should return as quickly as possible to what is the focal point, if you like, of American power, which is maritime capability. And as and when you focus on the United States maritime capability, what you see is a nation which, as the distribution of power changes internationally, at least a friendly guarantor of the commons. So the intense competition in the Indian Ocean is not an American competition. It's the intense competition is that complex rivalry that Robert describes between China and India. Mm. And the United States is in some ways able to take stand one out, one back from that. But, as he says, an immensely powerful maritime presence. So I think the Indian Ocean is not a difficult area for the United States. It's an area of opportunity, and with not a huge amount at stake. Robert may disagree with that. But thinking about it geopolitically, which is a discipline that we don't impose sufficiently on ourselves, because we tend to think about international politics ideally rather than geopolitically, then different parts of that ocean start to assume enormous significance. And it's interesting, Robert talks about Sri Lanka. If you look at the one major mistake the Japanese made in World War II is not to take Ceylon when they could have. Now, the Germans wanted them to, and had they done it, when they're in a position to be able to do it, as they dominated the Bay of Bengal, they could have interrupted the passage of munitions and supplies to the Soviet Union, which in 1942 virtually went entirely through the Indian Ocean. And if it hadn't done that up through Iran, if it hadn't done that in 1942, the Soviet Union would have collapsed. But the Japanese attacked in the South Seas instead towards Australia. They did a lateral attack too through Burma, but not the main effort. So, you've got to look at things geopolitically every now and then if you want to see what the outcome's likely to be, rather than just, as I said, ideally.
I want to get to what and how, in fact, it might work. But you mentioned Burma there, Kim, and in fact, Robert Kaplan, you alerted me to the degree to which the Chinese are also dealing with Burma.
Yes. The Chinese are putting a lot of effort into developing modern deep water ports along the Indian Ocean littoral in Pakistan, in Burma, in Bangladesh, in Sri Lanka, ports that they won't control. In some cases, for instance, in Pakistan, the Port of Singapore Authority will be running the port in Gwadar. The Chinese don't need total control. They need great political, military relations with these countries and access
the
most modern facilities, leverage. But Burma is the closest case, I think, in the whole of the Indian Ocean where the Chinese footprint is very deep and not very subtle. It's subtle in Sri Lanka to a greater extent it is in Pakistan. But in Burma, the Chinese are in lockstep with that regime.
Coming back to where we head next, we've only got a few more minutes. You don't, in fact, Robert, promote a sort of NATO-style alliance emerging to try to manage all these competing strategic interests. You seem to me to say, no, we can step back from that. Can you outline why?
Yeah, because the Indian Ocean is big, and ships, even the fastest warships, travel relatively slow. You can't be in many places at once. And the Indian Ocean has different parts. It has the Arabian Sea, the Gulf of Aden, the Bay of Bengal. Even the South China Sea is part of the greater Indian Ocean. And so that's why you're going to have different alliance formations in different parts of the ocean. I could see Australia, for instance, playing a greater role, perhaps, in the South China Sea in the future, which is to China. The Chinese look at the South China Sea the way the United States looked at the Caribbean Sea when we were building the Panama Canal, as an international body of water, but yet nevertheless part of their own backyard.
You've got a lovely lovely quote here, quoting Vice Admiral John Morgan, the former Deputy Chief of US Naval Operations: "The Indian Ocean strategic system should be like the New York City taxi system, driven by market forces and with no central dispatcher." Kim Beazley, do you think that would work, and where would the Australian Navy play a role?
Doesn't need to be quite that chaotic. But it's always easy to get a taxi in New York, it has to be said. So there you are. Look, I think that Robert's description of it is essentially correct. Look, and this is the advantage of the United States. Practically every country in the region wants a bilateral relationship with the United States. They don't want to be in it with the United States along with other people. They want that relationship directly themselves to manage it within the framework of what they're comfortable with. This is an enormous advantage for the United States. And that they're actually so distant from the area but seen as a legitimate player, that's also an enormous advantage for the US. Now, for us, well, we always have to remember that the South China Seas is closer to Darwin than Melbourne is. And it is very much part of our adjacent waters. That's nothing new. We have been patrolling the area of the Malacca Straits with surveillance aircraft, RAAF surveillance aircraft, for decades. We have a five-power defence arrangement with Singapore and Malaysia, which is predominated by Australians, which see our people more or less permanently in Butterworth in Malaysia. And there's always a keenness in that region to have a substantial Australian presence. So we are there. It is part of our strategic zone. It is part of, at least its approaches, a part of a strategic zone in which we have said we need to structure our armed forces to be able to dominate. We have now something like 13 anti-terrorist agreements of different descriptions with most of the nations of that part of the archipelago. So we're a pretty big player in that zone.
Look, thank you, gentlemen. Very interesting discussion. Kim Beazley, thank you very much to you.
Oh, very good to be with you, Jerry.
And Robert Kaplan, it's terrific that you set off this, well, it's not a debate, it's alerting us to something that we ought to be much more aware of. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Robert Kaplan, he's a national correspondent for The Atlantic and a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. And his article for Foreign Affairs was reprinted in the Australian Financial Review on Friday the 17th of April, if you care to go and seek it out. It's a very good piece.